Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Devin Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and I am so excited to get into this conversation and talk about building science and ways to build better buildings. And to do that, we have to have guiding principles that can help us do this. And we're going to go down this journey, but the tagline that we're using here is all about zero is the goal, net zero. Zero is the goal, FIAS is the means. And so we're going to learn a lot about that conversation through this. But first, I want to kind of bring some of the kindling as this fireside chat is really growing around building science. Recently, we just released a podcast titled Don't Sell Passive House, which is actually a play on words because one of our superstars, Johnny Resvani on show 244, runs a company about supplying products to Passive House and does a great job of educating and understanding how and why these products fit into this scene. Show 230, Green Building is the New Green Thumb, with Gregory Ingalls, where it was a really good story talking about the evolution of in Colorado, about the Colorado Green Building Guild and all the stuff they've done. And we're going to talk about zooming out and zooming back in into the riches and the niches of having people working together in different processes for a common goal. Or other specific things like show 124, titled The Ageless Home and Universal Design. And when we talked to Valley Jurek Henry on that about CAPS or Certified Aging in Place, it was a really cool story about these different things of solving challenging things around building better buildings. Or where this conversation really got launched was all the way back in 2017, show 71 titled Advanced Building Science Standardization to the Rescue. And that's where I got to interview Mariana and Enrico of EMU Systems. And I learned at the time, I didn't even know what PHI was. And we're going to learn about these different acronyms to say, just recently, I thought that was the only standard. And there are other things and other different ways to do that. So the main message that I want to convey to you, Tribe, is that we want to discuss how FIAS differs from other building standard platforms. And so PHI, P-H-I, stands for Passive House Institute, which was the origin out of that was in Germany. And you can go back and learn about that through EMU and other platforms that I just mentioned. FIAS, P-H-I-U-S, Passive House Institute U.S. What's the difference? And I just learned that there is a different one. And so that's where I'm really excited for you to go on this journey with us all today. And how that's going to benefit you is that we have to discuss how we can use these different standards to build better buildings. And so I've had the pleasure of being in some really cool passive house projects and owning a window and door company in Colorado. They're amazing, but I can tell you I've done way more than I've actually got to go into because they can be expensive, or a lot of times I get value engineered out in Tribe. I don't know about you, but for me, that's the opposite of building better buildings. So we've discussed Passive House a few times, and now it's time to learn the backstory of the North American standard and what's unique about that. And how do we bring economies of scale to Passive House? Because there's so many great things they're doing to build as many better buildings as possible. So to do that, we get to have Katrine, or Kat, Klingenberg, the co-founder and executive director of FIAS, as well as Isaac Elnikove, and I'll have him say his full name because I think I got that right, because I'm always working hard to learn this for seven times for the first time I raised my hand, and you're going to hear these acronyms and stuff so we can help get this together, Tribe. And he is an analyst that really is going to talk through how some of this stuff works. So I'm really excited to have both of them come in and have the conversation. So without further ado, let's truly get into this P-H-I-U-S and talk about how we can build better buildings together. Lock and load, Tribe. What's your favorite beverage?
Definitely red wine.
Ooh, what's one that comes to mind?
Preferably Pinot Noir.
All right. Is it a certain one, a certain region? Whenever we go down the wine
really,
train.
Really, I really like the Northwest, I have to tell you. The Oregon Pinot Noirs.
Awesome.
My favorite.
Cool. Well, tell us about the favorite place you've traveled, Kat.
Well, I like all places, really. I like travel in general, but probably the most exciting place was Shanghai. I really enjoyed the international metropolis flair, feel, food, everything was just fantastic.
Cool. Give us one specific story from your experience there.
Definitely going to some insider restaurants. We were with actually Chinese hosts who knew what they were doing, and we got to experience some really outlandish food that had to be underground for like a really long time, that kind of stuff. You know, it's like stuff that you don't eat like every day.
I'm curious, what's delicious. What's the first thing you ate?
I cannot remember. It was meat that had to be like dug into the ground. It's like, and it seemed like a kind of like a dicey proposition to me, but I tried it and it was an interesting taste, but it was totally worth it to do it. And awesome. It was a great culinary experience because it was so different from what I knew, you know. Nothing like the Chinese restaurants over here.
Outstanding. Well, what do you like to do outside of the art of construction arena when you're working with FIAS that we passionately call the art of construction?
Well, I also happen to be an architect, so I like to design spaces. And when I don't do that, I like to cook. I'm really into healthy food, and food for me is almost like an energy balance for the body. So very similar to what we do in building science. I enjoy that a lot. So that's like meditative being with yourself, like taking care of yourself, cooking for friends, the whole thing, the whole experience.
Well, outstanding. Well, let's get going on this journey, and we're going to kind of talk the envelope around FIAS, the big picture, and then we'll go and talk with some specific questions with Isaac and circle this back. So, Kat, tell us the story how you got into Passive House.
Yeah, so that really started very early on. So in high school already, I kind of veered or tended to go towards the environmental side of things. They started us off with easy stuff, of course, in high school, like recycling and gardening and all that. But then at the end of my high school days, there was the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit. And that really struck me as something that was really, really important to solve the climate crisis. So it was on my radar right from the beginning, once I got out of school, high school. And I decided to become part of the solution with my professional choice. Not really right away when I got into architecture, but definitely later on when I found myself in the profession itself, and I felt like the whole like serious environmentalism regarding averting climate change pretty much was absent. The discussion revolved around design and high design and that kind of stuff, but building science was in my mind really the most important thing that we had to tackle with that energy and carbon. So very early on, I thought I wanted to have my own business, make the decision. I'm not going to work on anything but buildings that actually meet our carbon reduction goals. So my personal goal has been right from the beginning, mitigating the climate crisis and to create a carbon neutral, healthy, safe, and just future. And so when I had the opportunity, I did that. I started looking around what were the leading standards out there. And in 2002, I built my passive house in Champaign-Urbana to, at the time, the German PHI standard. And that was the beginning. That was the first project that they had outside of the European Union in the English-speaking country. I actually worked with them to translate the PHPP into the English language and also into IP units, which made it possible that it even like got a foothold in the United States. So, and that's really where FIA started. I started the little original cell in 2002 in the United States.
Awesome. Well, what a great lead in to where I really want to hear the story from the person who started this, the origin story of Passive House Institute United States. And when you say PS, FIAS, this, it's like you hear all these things. I'm like, what are they talking about? Like, so I'd love for you to kind of go down the origin story as one of the tribe members that's just trying to figure out all this stuff to help us move forward.
Oh, yeah. So it was a fun story. Like I always thought that buildings were really at the core of this, the fundamental solution to the climate crisis, because as we all know, buildings are responsible for over 40% of the carbon emissions on the planet. And if we don't tackle that chunk, if we don't reduce it by essentially a factor of 10, which, by the way, came out of the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in 1992, factor 10 reduction in energy consumption and carbon emissions. If we don't do that, then we don't really have a chance to mitigate the climate crisis so that we avoid really negative impacts on the planet. So at that time, I decided to basically take my profession and put it in service of tackling this problem and built my house first as an example, just to see, like, can we even do this? Like, do we have the materials in the United States? How far can we go with this? How much energy can we actually save? Build it first, model, then measure, verify, all these things, right? A proof of concept, basically. We did that and we found like some really great things, that it was actually not that hard to build, for one. Number two, we had all the materials we needed in North America. Number three, there was already a very strong history of energy efficient construction. And I dug in a little deeper, and ironically, like, this first passive house that I built in the US to the German standard led me to the history of where the Germans got the idea from. And they got it from North America, like as an answer to the oil embargo in 1973. The Department of Energy funded a lot of energy research and really deep, deep, deep energy efficiency research. And some of that at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, where I was building my house. So the Small Homes Council, some of your listeners might be familiar with that, a very, very significant research institution. Rumor has it that the air conditioning was invented there. And so they had been at it and had built a whole bunch of essentially passive houses already in 1973 in Champaign-Urbana. And then I went further. I'm like, well, were there more? And I uncovered this entire incredible history of the super insulation movement. And I also found that the term passive house was actually coined in Canada by Canadian researchers of the same kind of like tribe who was trying to solve that problem at the time. I have papers from 1974, Canadian Passive House Conference. So it's really awesome. Once you dive into the history, it's really interesting. So, but the cool thing was, like, back to 2002, when I was building my house, a lot of those first super insulators and construction folks were still around, and also the building science people. And I quickly found them too. So a lot of them had huddled around Joe Stiebrig and Building Science Corporation, around like the other half in Canada, Building Science Corporation, John Straub, now with RDH. So there's a long history. And I was really encouraged by that, because the skill was there clearly. And everybody knew about airtight construction, potential moisture problems, vapor control layers, water control layers, all that stuff. So that, in my mind, was a really great position to start with, because if we want to scale this, and in my mind was like, this had to be standard to be successful in some way or shape or form, we needed that skill in the building community. And I was so thrilled when I actually found that already existed.
Wow. Like, I just learned so much. And that's what I just love about this podcast, of a few things that I have to circle back of: model, measure, verify. And so when you start getting these talking tracks, we can start understand from the origin story about how we can move this thing forward. And first, what, man, I commend you from high school to saying, I'm going to go out to solve these things, to then going out. You didn't just start from scratch. You went out and said, what has already been done and how can I work from that to get this right kit of parts? And as a supply person, I'm like passionate about the right construction technologies, materials, and handshakes, putting all that stuff together and the super insulation movement. It's like these riches in the niches with these super insulation movements have been fascinating for me to see of the rise and fall of spray foam and the rise and fall of EFIS and these different things over the years to try to understand. But we're going to talk through FIAS North America, that North America to Germany, but it actually started in Canada, if I heard you right. Of like
Canada and the US.
So I raised my hand, say I didn't know that, even though I've heard a lot of this stuff. It's just that's what I love about hearing the talking tracks about to scale, you need to have standards, right? And that's how this whole thing started. So can you go into more detail of why you decided to create a North American standard for passive house? And I'm really curious of, from your point of view, what is the difference versus the standard PHI?
Yeah. So I'll take you up on the offer again of like storytelling, right? There's more to the story. So after we built the first house in Champaign-Urbana, we got a grant and we got to build a couple more in Urbana, and people took notice, and then they said, like, can you teach us? And like very soon we developed a training curriculum. That was before the Germans even had a training curriculum. We started training and we started traveling from east to west and training builders and architects and the trades, whoever showed up and whoever found us, right? So, and at that point, some of those early building scientists, some of your listeners might know Mark Rosenbaum, who's a very inquisitive building scientist and engineer. They showed up for our very first training and they asked some really tough questions. And we based our training also on the German standard. So we started teaching like 15 kilowatt hours per square meter a year. And like the seasoned super insulators, they were like, why? Why that number? And at the time, I really had no idea where did this number come from. So I started studying it. And again, I went back to the first super insulators because I knew the German PHI, they had learned a lot from those early writings, William Shorcliffe, so was a physicist who taught at MIT. So what I found was that actually those early physicists who started describing the passive house movement in North America, they had a very similar like goal of factor 10 reduction of the demand. And they also associated a peak load with the annual consumption. And that peak load was very similar to what the Germans used to define their standard. So I traced that back. They took the 1 watt per square foot. It's actually in the very first edition of the energy code in the United States. There's something in there that says you don't have to have a heating system if your building has a peak heat load of 1 watt per square foot, which basically means if you have a room of 100 square feet, and you have a 100-watt light bulb, you have enough internal heat gain to keep that 100 square foot if your 100 square foot room has like a peak load of 1 watt per square foot. So the Germans took exactly that definition, applied it to the German climate, and turns out in the German climate, it works almost perfectly because it's mild, it's heating dominated, there's no cooling. And then next step, when they had some initial success with that, they found out that nobody understood peak load, but they wanted to popularize it and sell it to the government and everything. So peak load didn't work, so they translated it into an annual 15 kilowatt hours per square meter a year in the German climate. And that essentially people could understand. That's like a miles per gallon for a building, right? We're using a certain amount of energy per square meter over the period of a year. So that is where those 50 kilowatt hours per square meter a year came from. That made it very clear to me that it was very climate specific. So when I built my house in Champaign-Urbana, we have cooling in Champaign-Urbana. We also have much more extreme peak loads for both, for heating and cooling. So I was my own living laboratory, basically. I found out very quickly that my building was overheating. I found out that my peak load, even though I met the 15 kilowatt hours per square meter a year, my peak load was much higher than the 1 watt that was the original definition of the German passive house, that you can stick like just a little bit of heat into the ventilation system and that is enough. I found that out because I had imported an ERV from Germany and it had an electric heating coil in it, sized for 1 watt per square foot. And I had some additional sources, like just to be sure in the floor, but it was a super, super cold winter, that first winter, and the relay blew because the small, tiny heater was on all the time. So I was lucky that my house didn't burn down. Fine, we got past this and we learned the lesson. So you already get the point. Like the different climates have different makeup. So turns out that the annual heating demand, the miles per gallon for houses, does not track with peak loads. The peak loads are different by climate, which then led me to the conclusion that the combination, and especially when you start designing for heating and cooling, and you need to balance it because too much insulation increases your heating. So at that point, you really have to find the right balance. So that led us to the conclusion that we needed a new standard and that we really have to find one that not only optimizes for climate, but, and with that for comfort, right? Because like the German standard just one-to-one applied in North America was leading to overheating and was kind of like misleading the designer to believe that they needed more insulation. But we also wanted to optimize for cost because we got these incredible solutions that were like my house had an 18 thick inch wall that there was no way we were going to sell people on that. Cost was the single most dominant hurdle that we were facing, and we had to solve for that. Now, at that point, also the imported stuff had to go. The imported stuff was expensive, so that wasn't helping us at all. We also weren't sure if the imported stuff that worked in Germany was actually appropriate for our climate. So all that stuff had to be translated. Lucky enough, we found plenty good materials in North America that we were able to make work. There's also a different balance in like the kind of specifications of the window versus heat gain. So that all had to be recalibrated. And last but not least, we also got funding from the Department of Energy together with Building Science Corporation and we worked with NREL. It was peer-reviewed paper, 2015. We developed a new methodology for the North American PASFA standard that is also cost optimized for the cost structure of North America. Not for Germany. Original German standard was optimized for an end townhouse in Germany in the 90s for their cost structure. So we redid all that. Once we redid all that, we had a standard that was more granular. We needed an annual demand for heating. We needed an annual demand for cooling. And they were different because you had to balance it correctly, depending on how many heating degree days you have and how many cooling degree days you have. And we also found that you needed the peak loads. So it's not just either or, peak or annual, you needed and. So our new standard that was developed with Building Science Corporation on a DOE grant, peer-reviewed by NREL and then published, that has now four targets, annual heating demand, cooling demand, peak heating, peak cooling, and they're all different and dialed in for each climate. So we had to bite the bullet and it's all cost optimized too.
So I have to recap a few things there because sometimes you may have to take a step back to take a step forward is what I'm hearing. And you started by train the trainer. Have you referenced some legends that have been Mark Rosenbaum? Did I hear that right?
So that's correct.
The different yes. people and all this stuff boils down to knowing your numbers. And it's really hard to know your numbers of all these moving parts, because if it's defined from one source of truth or peak loads, it's really hard to be understood by all if it's specific to a more local area, in this case, Germany. And so that when you went and created this living laboratory, you had to look at product that was optimized for your local conditions. Things like putting in an 18 inch wall and all these things to make it work, you're looking at this saying, this is going to be hard to build better buildings with this type of needed parameters, when in the US, you don't see a lot of 18 inch walls and products optimized around that. So then you had to go, say, you know, the products matter, but you have to understand how the products ratings match up with the municipalities that all come together. And it all boils down into balance. And I'm working with so many different modular factories that we call system build living, putting together these different chain of commands of people and products. It's all about compromise, right? And so balance is about putting peak performance with annual performance and putting that stuff together, because you have to, what you measure will grow, but you got to make sure you're measuring the right things. Am I understanding kind of the platform of the evolution for the US and the PHI part of this?
Yes. So it's a more granular, complex problem in the US because we have heating, cooling, and not to mention dehumidification. So that gets thrown in there too. And the balance, the optimized balance point is just not the same as in Germany.
And so you talked about your local area, and I would just be curious to have you go, for example, how is passive house optimized for climate? You know, what about Colorado as an example, where we have these major temperature fluctuations?
Yeah, see, like Colorado has a fascinating climate. It's really great. So very, very cool story again for that one, because for one, our climate-specific standard was peer-reviewed and then published by NREL, which, you know, is very close to gold in Colorado. And I've been there multiple times. And after we published that methodology, how to develop this more granular standard for North America, actually, a good friend of mine, Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute, he had decided to build new headquarters in Basalt. And so he was trying to get to the same thing that we were working on. He had looked at the German standard. He's like, yeah, no, this is not working here. Because he came to the same conclusions. He has been doing this even longer than the German Passive House Institute. Like, again, like Feist was inspired by Amory Lovins. So at that point, really cool. He had like a whole bunch of like engineers cost optimize his building, and they did all kinds of like difficult energy models and that kind of stuff. And so I said, well, could we like use our new targets for your headquarters in Colorado? And he said, yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. That would be really cool to see. And we came up with the exact same solution that like he had like, I don't know how many models they ran, how many like his engineering team from all kinds of different angles of economic optimization. And basically what we created was a shortcut for that, applicable. And we ran these targets for all different climate zones that we had climate data for, not just zones, but locations in North America, including Colorado. So in Colorado, we have data for like a whole bunch of different locations.
Well, great job on the overview. Let's switch gears and bring our other guest into Art of Construction here. Isaac, what is your favorite beverage?
Well, my favorite beverage is something called Guarana soda, which is a Brazilian soda made from a fruit you find in Brazil called the Guarana, which is a very, very, it's a very yummy, sweet fruit juice, which is, I can't get enough of. It's hard to find, but I can't get enough of.
Well, I look forward to someday having one of those with you, because I don't even know where I'm going to start to look, because I couldn't even pronounce back what you said. Kind of hopefully I got your full name right on the beginning of this.
Sure.
So full name and where you're from, and then tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
Sure. My name is Isaac Alnicove, and I've gone from a lot of places, but I was born in Puerto Rico, but grew up in Los Angeles, and now live in Chicago. Hence the Guarana. I have a Caribbean, Latin American background. My favorite place that I've traveled was really a trip I took down the Klamath River one time, well, a couple of times back when I lived in California, where we would head up north and take about 3 or 4 days just rafting down the river, which for me was wonderful because it was actually among the quietest places you ever been to. And it was a great place, great way to just get away and be able to be introspective and be kind of away from all the distractions and be able to, it's a great place for kind of recentering myself when I've done this.
How did you meet Kat?
Well, I mean, that comes into where my FIAS story comes in, but I met her at one of the FIAS conferences. I believe it was 2015.
We'll let you tell that because I'm jumping out of line here to give the whole story. But what do you like to do when you're not helping with FIAS in the art of construction?
What I really enjoy doing, and I've been doing this since, since preteen days, I play a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. And one of the things that I've been doing a lot more now is getting my kids involved in it. So I help run the worlds for them as they're learning how to play. One is 16, one is 11. So they're getting into it, and it's a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Being able to transfer that.
Well, give us your overall story, that led you into Passive House.
Sure. Well, mine goes a little bit of a different direction. My background is both as a structural engineer and a policy analyst. I've got degrees in both. And I started my career as a structural engineer in California. And one of the things that I was doing when I was this goes back to the 1980s, is I used to do what were called the original Title 24 worksheets. And if you know Title 24, that's the code in California. Well, no. Now it's like a 500-page long code. In the late 1980s, it was a one-page worksheet. It's kind of grown. So I started doing energy work back then. And once I had been part of the career, I realized that there was a real good connection between energy use and the built environment, because I did do a lot of the design work, the structural engineering work as well. And so I combined those. And about 20 years ago, I started doing work on codes, on energy codes, in both the Northeast and in the Midwest. And what I learned was that you can do a lot of good advocating for and working to improve energy codes, but it's really slow. It moves very slowly. And so one of the things I started looking at was, how do we move energy efficiency construction forward more quickly? And then, you realize that, and I realized that there was that you have to think about this almost as a ladder, where codes is the bottom rung of the ladder, and then you move up into other standards that are more energy efficient. And I saw FIAS, and I participated here in Chicago in the FIAS Alliance group as they were working on this. And then that convinced me to go, as I was doing my codes work, that convinced me to go to the FIAS conference in Chicago, I believe, in 2015. And that's where I met Katrine and, started, I was going to say haranguing. I don't know if that's the correct word, but telling her about my ideas about how to move FIAS forward. And then, move over a few years after I moved away from doing codes work and thinking, how can I really move policy forward? And it was like, I got the opportunity to work at FIAS. I happen to live in Chicago. FIAS is based in Chicago. It's a wonderful connection. And I've started working there. And it's given me the great thing about it is that it's given me the opportunity. In the old days, I was working on codes. I'm working kind of at the, trying to move the floor up. Now I get to actually think about how to move the ceiling up, if you will, or how to get things, how to really establish within policy the highest levels and how to move that forward. And with the idea that moving that up and moving that forward, you'll also eventually bring the codes up into that level. And that's what we're seeing that's what we're seeing happening right now.
I just want to pause and say, like, this is such a joy for me as a student in the art of construction, of giving this context of where we're coming from and where we're going. And when you're talking about connecting energy use in the built environment, it's really hard because there's so many different points of view with that stuff to hear these, where it's coming from. And energy codes can do really good stuff, but it's slow. So it's managing the baseline and putting that stuff together and how to move energy efficiencies forward, starting with those codes. You had mentioned the FIAS Alliance group, and I raised my hand to say, I'm really intrigued what you're talking about. And I haven't heard of that organization. And I use the podcast of the Art of Construction, and a lot of the tribe now uses this platform to say, where should we go and what should we do to build better buildings? Because what I heard you say is that you went to the Felis Alliance Group, met Kat, and that's where you actually are now, you broke through the policy ceiling and now you're continuing to elevate that. So I'm really curious, what is the Felis Alliance Group?
Well, I'll start a little bit and then I'll let Kat finish that. As part of Felis, there are what are called Felis Alliance Groups across the country, where the actual, in many ways, the actual practitioners who are working on Felis and working on Felis buildings get together to discuss all the various aspects. And that includes how to build a Felis, what are some of the issues around it, how to address them, talking about the particular policy questions within their particular area. In other words, if, you know, the Felis Alliance Chicago is going to have different questions than the Alliance Group in Colorado, than the Alliance Group in Massachusetts, for example. So it's a way to get the practitioners together and really tackle the, if you will, the local issues, because while the Felis standard can be considered national, right, it plays out differently in different parts of the country. And you have to be very aware and cognizant that that's how it works, because you can't maximize, you can't optimize unless you're really thinking about the on-the-ground conditions in a given spot. And that's what a lot of the Felis Alliance groups really do, think about how it matters in their spot.
That's great. Kat, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, sure. Maybe only little bit about the history. When the Felis Alliance was initially called the Passive House Alliance U.S., and it was founded in 2009, and so all the Passive House groups in the U.S. minus like the Canadians really came out of our initial trainings that we started in 2008 and 2009. Yeah, and then later on, we decided to rebrand, and we basically renamed the Passive House Alliance US chapters the Felis Alliance chapters. So that's where we're at today.
Got it. So to piggyback off of, I totally agree with what Isaac's talking about, where the Art of Construction coaches different window dealers around the country, and it's fascinating about what one window dealer will get very specific about of the different municipalities, about the different alliances that I've heard you create now. Isaac, tell us about the current rebate being offered in Colorado for the fire rebuilds, because the riches are in the niches where you can hear these things to maybe use best practices, and what the builders need to know about that the rest of the global megaphone could maybe learn and use for best practices moving forward.
Sure. So this is an interesting and a really fascinating opportunity that that arose because of the tragedy due to the Marshall Fire. Because it was such a very so widespread in terms of the damage. Excel Energy, which is the utility in that region, is looking to try to rebuild in a way that actually improves beyond just the basic code, as we were talking before. So the idea behind these incentives is to encourage people who are rebuilding to rebuild at a higher standard than just the code, and that is really their aim in this. So I really applaud Excel for taking the lead on this point. So they have a three-tiered structure where they will give some level of incentive for building to the Department of Energy's Zero Energy Ready Homes program. If you want to go a little higher, you can go to the Energy Star, build to the Energy Star level. And if you want to go to the highest level, you will build to the Felis level, where you can receive a rebate of $37,500 as part of to build to Felis. So it's a very significant incentive. The idea being that they want to make sure that people who are interested and serious about rebuilding at a higher standard, you know, it pays, or at least they're not held harmless financially. I think, they're being very serious about this. We have had discussions as to what entails saying telling Excel that they are, that somebody's building the FIIAS, and that you have to actually register with FIIAS to be able to tell Excel, I'm going to build to pass files. You just can't send them a letter saying I'm going to do so. You have to actually register, sign a contract to be certified. And then we've had discussions as to, you know, at what level the funding, the rebate occurs once the building is substantially completed, so that people get what they're looking for. But they have established, my understanding is that they've established no limits to the number of homes that can be built to this. They are looking to have homes built to this higher standard, and they want to hold people harmless financially, and they want to encourage this kind of construction. And I want to end, or I kind of want to take this back, because I think it's something you said, but I want to really kind of emphasize part of the idea behind doing this is the more homes you build to the FIIAS standard, the more you build the kind of infrastructure, both technical, material, economic, to build more in the future. Right now, you know, there's always that step you have to take to get over the hump, if you will, in terms of building it. Builders, it is a more rigorous and challenging way to build. And so builders have to kind of take, you know, you have to learn, and you learn by doing it. And the more that people build and ask for it, the more builders get the training, the more builders get the experience. And that, in its sense, builds that infrastructure. And one of the things we found in, and we can now get this in a bit later, but as this kind of infrastructure and ecosystem gets built, the costs start going down pretty significantly. Once people understand what needs to be done and have the experience to do it. And so yeah, I think this is a wonderful opportunity for this.
I totally agree. And I appreciate you kind of shedding light to that, because I live here in Colorado, and I'm struggling between what news outlets and what you're seeing of how this works. And I commend Excel as well of looking at a unique opportunity of a tragic situation for a lot of people to help break through these ceilings through that and educate how we shoot past the baseline, right? And so you have to create these tiers to accommodate how we build better buildings. I want to zoom out a little bit about when we talk about meaningful change. You know, single family is a great place, but also we got to look at multifamily and other segment types to really discuss this, right? And so, Isaac, and then I want to you turn it over to Kat. In the pre-interview discussions, you talked about this surge of passive house multifamily developments. Can you talk about that, and then talk about why this recent surge around that?
I think the surge in multifamily developments comes from a lot of thinking about, as we talk about, you know, expanding the universe of energy efficient homes and dwellings, right? It really needs to be a broadly democratic, if you will, development. The eventual vision is everybody should have the ability to live in a house that's at passive house standards. And so one of the things that, you know, we focus on is affordable multifamily developments. And through that, there's a policy instrument called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit, which is a federal legislation from, I believe, the 1980s, from the tax bill, that helps fund affordable housing developments in states. And how this works is that they set up a set of criteria for awarding this tax credit to developers. So it's kind of a competitive process through a state housing agency. They set up criteria. And one of the sets of criteria almost always involves energy efficiency or sustainable standards. And what we found in places like Pennsylvania, as I think the kind of one of the originators of this, is that if you include passive house as one of the criteria, then developers are willing to take that jump to building affordable multifamily developments to the FIIAS standard. As I can tell you, I think for a lot of people, this was a fairly scary proposition in the beginning. But what we found, and we've seen this in multiple states, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, New York, Illinois, Washington State, is that the same story plays itself out. As people build to the passive house standard, to the FIIAS standard, they get this kind of experience. And as the experience comes in, the projects get done quicker, they get done better. You're able to find the subcontractors who know how to work this. Then you find the architects who know how to design to it. And so we've seen this, as this has happened and the cost has gone down, all of a sudden there's been this huge number, this huge increase in numbers. I'm going to give you one very, very important data point, and then I'll turn it over to Kat. The Massachusetts did a study. They funded eight affordable multifamily projects across the state with the intent of finding out what is the incremental cost to building to the FEIA standard in a state like Massachusetts. And they've done the eight projects and they have done the analysis, and they have found that the range of incremental cost has been 1-4% over code, which from a lot of people's perspective generally means that there's really no incremental cost, since other costs can often swamp that number. As that's happened, I'm going to turn it to Katrine, and she can tell you what that means for the number of projects.
Yeah, so that has been really quite an exciting ride over the last, let's say, 3-4 years or so. As Isaac mentioned, it started with the QAP and those incentives, and that got people in the door. And then states saw the initial success in multifamily. Then they incentivized larger scale competitions because they wanted to have proof of concept, right? And there's another Buildings of Excellence competition going in New York. And we're starting to get similar numbers back from there, as Isaac just mentioned, for Massachusetts. Now, specifically for FEIA projects, and since we're talking about the FEIA standard and how it's different from the German standard, for us, it's particularly rewarding because we're seeing out the cost optimization of the standards play out. So when Isaac quotes the 1-4% in Massachusetts, those projects that were selected for that competition were all FEIA projects. So, and then in the Buildings of Excellence, we have almost 50% FEIA projects. And then we have PHI, ERI/ Zero Energy Ready Home, and ASHRAE sharing the remaining half at like equal amounts of projects. And same here, we're seeing the building, the FEIA projects perform at the best level and cost like a very little compared to PHI projects, in some cases, almost a factor of 2. So again, back to the start of our discussion, like climate, cost, and comfort optimized projects, that is really crucial to exponential uptake. And that's what we're seeing right now. Most people are not aware of this, especially not the ones in the PHI universe, but FEIA certifies 80% of all projects in North America, PHI 20. Well, maybe with the exception of Vancouver. So that is because people find that those targets are actually really helping to reduce costs. You mentioned you have like a window company. We don't have fixed, like you must. There is no you shall. All requirements are actually based in building science. So in many cases, we have rules. We've actually looked at like, why do you need a window and why does it have to be such high performing? There's a building science reason for that. And you can actually back out the specifications to make your overall cost go down. And that optimization, that's what we're seeing playing out in these proof of concept competitions. And that has driven our exponential uptake. For 22, we are projecting 30 million square feet. And that is like 10 million square meters. And in the US and Canada and some in Mexico alone. So that is a significant number. It's no longer a niche. And we're very, very happy to see that.
Well, I'm proud of you for all the work. It's got to be great to see this stuff coming out of proof of concept of all these years of you put into making this dream come to life. Like, I commend you for all this work you've done. Who all can get FEIA certified, and what is that process? If you talk about, you can't, as Isaac said at the case study with Colorado, you don't just tell them and send them. There's a process. How do you get certified, and what is that process?
Yeah, and that process is really important to success, right? So as a builder, as a developer, you want to make sure that you get the energy savings that your consultant is promising you in the model. How do you get certified? You start signing up with the certification process very early on. The FEIA office is essentially functioning as like the super consultant who comes on to a team and helps. And our folks are incredible. They have seen like hundreds of projects go across their desk by now. They are very experienced. So, and we have a very detailed certification process that makes sure that nothing falls through the cracks, that you're not making a mistake, that there are no surprises. There's a very stringent quality assurance process also for on-site. It's not just the design certification, to make sure that then the building actually performs as it was modeled. And our tool that we've developed with the Fraunhofer Institute for Building Physics, we don't use the PHPP. For example, we use the Woofy Passive tool. It has been proven to be about like plus minus 7% correct in terms of like prediction. And as far as I understand that from my building science friends, that's pretty much best in class. And at that point, if we have a very reliable certification process that leads to performance as predicted, then you can really start to sell this to the developer as a reliable business model, which then again also propels widespread uptake. We just had our developer summit, and that was the big selling proposition. If we can prove that our buildings only cost like 3 or 4% additional cost incrementally, and we can prove that they perform within like, let's say, 5 to 7% of modeled, at that point, the developer has an excellent case. And the risk, it's a risk management tool. And therefore, certification really is important, not only for quality assurance, but also to manage risk, including building science, like mold or whatever. Like we check for all that as well, like condensation potential during the certification.
Love it. Setting up the rules of the game and then setting the practices so you can truly set up these economies of scale right here in the good old US of A, right? Isaac, can you briefly recount the recent legislation proposed to Colorado around the grants for these high performance building?
Sure. And actually, let me take one little step back to, because there's an additional aspect to the certification process I think is really important. FIAS has developed and manages a very robust training program so that we are training both the what are called the CPHCs, which are the Certified Passive House Consultants, which are the people who actually really work with the architects, or in sometimes in many cases are the architects themselves, on developing the models and developing the drawings for doing this. We also have training for Certified Passive House Builders to make sure that the builders have a sense of how to do this. And we also have a sort of training for the energy raters so that they can do the quality control. So as Katrine said, we have the office in Chicago does a lot of the centralized review, but we have people all across the country who are the people who are doing the designs, doing the construction, and doing the checking.
Yeah, thanks, Isaac. And there are more than like probably close to 4,000 trained by now. And like we have active almost 2,000 professionals now.
And to add, as you develop policies and strengths, the numbers of people within a given area starts to really grow. So let me quickly talk about this legislation, which is basically about disaster preparedness and recovery, which obviously is an issue that people are very much paying attention to right now. So it has three sections. Basically, number one, it creates this legislation, which is SB22-206. It creates a disaster resilience rebuilding program. And its purpose is to provide loans and grants to homeowners, owners of residential retail properties, businesses, governmental entities, and other organizations, basically focusing on rebuilding after a disaster emergency. So this is not just tied in. This is a recognition that what happened in Boulder County can very well continue to happen, and you have to be prepared about it, and you have to be prepared for it. And you have to set up the systems beforehand to deal with it. So it's basically focusing on providing the funding to subsidize the cost to repair, rebuild neighborhoods, provide capital to businesses experiencing loss, and helping reimburse governmental entities because they themselves have to often spend a lot of money in the rebuilding process. So that's the first one. The second one is basically creating a sustainable rebuilding program within the Colorado Energy Office. And this one is going to be kind of managing those grants and saying, what can these loans and grants be used for? And some of the things that they've said that you can use these loans and grants for is, in a rebuilding program, is installing high efficiency heat pumps, achieving the advanced energy certifications we talked about, which does include Passive House FIAS, but does also include things like Energy Star. It also talks about assisting with the cost of battery storage and electric vehicle charging stations, thinking a little bit in the within the resilience universe, and obviously covering sometimes the incremental cost of building to the most recent energy standard, which was obviously, as you know, an issue in discussion in Louisville and Superior. And finally, it creates an Office of Climate Preparedness in the governor in the governor's office to help coordinate all these activities.
I love talking through these specifics, right? And we'll put links to this stuff in the show notes, because if you're in Colorado, you better be paying attention to that stuff, but also use those tools to put it into your municipalities. And it all boils down to the Art of Construction tribe, all of us working as lifelong learners, right? And that's the theme I've heard this whole way through this conversation of continuing to learn and grow and work together. But to do that, we have to systemize that, right? And so the question I've asked from the very beginning to wherever this thing goes, it's just been such an honor to be able to turn on the microphone and be able to fast track to learn where we've come from when it comes to putting the U.S. after the Passive House Institute. And as we close this thing out, I'm going to ask Isaac and then Kat a couple key questions that we always ask to close this thing out. So Isaac, what is your crystal ball for the future with technology and construction?
Well, I will tell you that the future really is in learning the systems to build to high energy to energy efficiency. I think in many ways, the materials are all here. Mm. What's really needed and what I think is going to be really focused on is making sure that the construction community knows how to use them and knows how to use them properly, so that the homes that are built up to stronger energy efficiency, higher energy efficiency, actually do so. You have to learn almost a new way of building to get to the next level. And I think that's where the future is, really, getting people to learn how the new construction techniques really work through.
Love it.
So that's
Kat, what is your crystal ball for the future with technology and construction?
Well, it's thinking right now, and like I'm thinking in two directions. For one, I totally agree with Isaac. So I think one thing is definitely going to be offsite construction and also a smart design. Like, so essentially like CS Roebuck 2.0, we need to figure that one out. Like basically passive level projects, not just passive level, but built-in components that take us to zero, right? And that takes me to my part two of the answer. The passive low load building at the center of the new renewable energy grid. So I think the technology of buildings is here. We know that we need to figure out better production and better and faster and more systematized. But really what we haven't really figured out yet is this new renewable energy grid, how the buildings plug in, how they benefit the grid, how to quantify the benefit of the low load building for the grid, for the overall system in a process of decarbonization, which we all must do on a whole systems country level. So
the same thing you've been doing since high school, right? At the beginning of this conversation.
Exactly. Like it's all completely making sense to me.
Yeah. Which I commend you for coming in and sharing the story and all the work you've done, because I've got so much clarity, and I hope the Art of Construction tribe is as well, of saying all of us lifelong learners working together to build better buildings, right? And what you focus on will grow. We might need to focus on a few other things other than when you go to the P&L, what is just that, right? And in using the municipalities to put that stuff together. But the last question we always ask, Isaac, and then Kat, what is that one thing, Isaac, you want to have our contractors and affiliates to think about as they go out there to crush it and grow their business?
Their ability, I think the thing that they need, and I'm going to go back to my original answer, is that understanding on how to build differently. I think there's going to be a limit to eventually the code homes that we built over the last decade, several decades. But they need to be able to start understanding how to air seal to really low levels. They need to understand how to incorporate exterior insulation better and more quick and more efficiently. The contractors and the affiliates who really get that are going to be, moving to the next level in Dungeons and Dragons almost. All of a sudden, your abilities and your skill levels grow and an entire universe opens up. But you need to be able to get those extra skills before you can do so.
I love it. From Isaac's Dungeon and Dragons Lifelong Lessons, Katrine, bring us home. What is that one thing for you?
Well, that one thing for me is like what I really would like builders and architects in general to understand is that picking the right standard is really important. A standard or a green building system, they do different things. Like understand what they do. Like LEED does different things than the energy efficiency people like ASHRAE or Zero Energy Ready Home, FIES, PHI. So different programs do different things. So be critical, investigate, and see which one does for you best what you need. Look for one that's cost optimized, that's climate optimized, and that has a very stringent quality assurance process and also a risk management process. As a builder, you want that risk buttoned up. You don't want to get callbacks. You don't want to have mold in your home arise. You want to like make sure that all the building science is being checked. And Isaac said it like really well during the previous interview. He said like the FIES system is a rope and a net process. So essentially the rope is the building science, all the checkpoints that we give you that you have to successfully pass. And the net is like, well, we'll catch you if you miss one. And all that together leads you to a successful project. And back to like the new renewable energy grid, once developers and builders add like an energy services component to their developers and builders model, and they want to actually monetize the savings that the process gives them, all these things become even more important. You want to make sure that the predictions are right and that they actually happen in reality later. So really cool stuff for the future. We're going to see a lot of really interesting stuff happening that will help the builders and the developers to find new business models to make this really, really scale up. I'm awesome. Very, very optimistic.
Well, I commend you. Thank you both so much for coming in and sharing your story. Great job.
Thank you, Devin. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
What a great touch point with the system build living. Know your numbers. What you focus on will grow. And Tribe, that's why we do this podcast, because it sounds so simple, but it's actually really hard. But you have to boil down is you have to get a kit of parts and become a lifelong learner. And that's what I really heard from them. They're the evolving. And then it's just as simple as this. You'll make mistakes and there'll be a net to catch you. Keep having as much fun as possible. This is so exciting because what we've been talking about for many years, and when Kat talks about Sears version 2, it's like I'm starting to see the evolution of that same pictures from forever ago. But you know what's really cool? We actually have the solution. Jump, we're here for you, Tribe. Have as much fun as possible, but don't keep doing the same stuff. There's a better way to build. And we're here on the Art of Construction to have your back. Crush it out there, Tribe.